Thank you, everyone, again for coming tonight. My name is Mrs. Goodman. I'm director of Chicago Hope, which is a mental health department of the Chicago Center. We take care of mental health referrals, education, prevention, and awareness. And we're very grateful to have tonight Reba Denicheski to present for the community. Very grateful to come a lot of time to make this happen. And we know Reba Denicheski is busy schedule. And we want to thank you very much for making this happen. Rabia Podanashevsky, LCSW, is the founder of Mind Body Therapy, a group practice specializing in trauma, addiction, and couples. He's also the author of the book Attached, which is a fantastic book. I read it. For all of you who have not read it, it is an excellent read. And host of the Attached Life podcast. Rabia also leads Beis Medrash Avodas Haliv, a local Chicago organization for adult learning and programming. For those of you who have not listened to Reb Denicheski's podcast or read his book or has not heard of the work that Reb Denicheski does, he does a lot of relational work, working with individuals, couples, and relationships, or as an individual in a relationship. And I'm sure we're all going to have a lot to glean from this event tonight and how we can increase our own skill set as individuals and in a relationship. And I want to thank everyone again in the community for making the time to come to this event and hope you all enjoy. And last thing I want to say is there is a Q&A box on the bottom for you to send in any questions for Rabbi Denishevsky that you feel isn't being covered or you would like specifically addressed. Rabbi Denishevsky will be able to retrieve the questions as they come along. So I'm going to hand over the floor to Rabbi Denishevsky. I'm going to close my video and enjoy. Any problems anyone has with any technical things that you may need to ask, just send me a question in the Q&A and I'll be happy to help you out. Thank you very much, Rabbi Denicheski. It's all yours.
Okay, thank you. It's really great to be here and appreciate the opportunity very much. So thank you, Mrs. Goodman, and thank you to the Chicago Center for all the work that they do in the mental health field and for the community and for this opportunity. So we're talking about marriage and we're going to address a specific topic and aspect within marriage in a moment. But just by way of introduction or hakdama, whenever I have the opportunity to talk about how we can work on and improve our marriages, I like to share a beautiful idea that I heard from a dear friend and teacher of mine, Rabbi Joey Rosenfeld, that I think is just so important to realize that the time that we're spending, the time that each of you has carved out from your schedule, life is busy and there's a lot going on for a lot of people, and the choice to prioritize spending some time this evening to work on marriage is no small thing. And I think it's something that people should understand the context of. We, in general, people are in some ways having struggles or challenges in their marriages. This is probably something that's gone on forever. Perhaps it might be the case that there's more of this now. I don't know. That might be true. And I think it's important to have a framing from a spiritual, a ruchnius perspective as to why that is and what that means, so that we can see these types of challenges in a ideal way, in a lechatchila way, meaning instead of thinking that we are in some sense broken or that there's something bad about the time that we're living in, but to be able to reframe it and see it positively. So I want to share with you this idea that he shared with me. The Gemara in Brachos says that there are three watches of the night, Gimel Mishmaros Halayla, three stages, three watches of the night. And the Gemara says that the very last mishmar, each of the mishmars, each of these stages, the watches, has an indication, representation of the time of that part of the night. And the last mishmar is represented or is indicated by what the Gemara describes as Isha Misaperes Im Baila, that a woman, a wife, is speaking to her husband. That indicates the very, very end of the night. The Maharsha explains that this is, in a sense, the Gemara essentially referring to some form of pillow talk. It's like the husband and wife are lying there right before their day starts, and she's whispering, she's speaking to her husband before they get up for their day. That's the very, very end of the night. That's what the Gemara says. So Rav Joey suggested that we might think about this Gemara in the following way. We know from many sources that nighttime represents galus. Nighttime is exile. Nighttime is darkness. It's confusion. It's the inability to see much beyond what's right in front of us. It's the feeling oftentimes that things are closing in or that there might not be potential, there might not be anything bright or anything light, anything to look towards. It's nighttime, it's dark, it's exile, galus. We, the Jewish people, have been living through a very, very, very long night. The entirety of our history has had many moments of stars shining through, but it's been a very long night. And in recent history, of course, we all know it's been a very dark night. And what the Gemara is saying is that what is the final frontier? What is the last stage of what we need to work on at the very end of this very long night, right before we merit to have the beginning of day, right before the sun comes up, the arrival of Mashiach, the time when the world will be flooded with the light of Hashem, the light of healing, the light of goodness, the light of love, the light of the presence of that which is beyond this world and will eventually fill this world, the beginning of day? What is the last thing that is going to need to be worked on and addressed and put, we're going to need to really invest, real kochos, to really work? What are we going to need to do? What is that going to be? Isha misaperis in baila. A husband and a wife speaking to each other. Why specifically is it the wife speaking? That's part of a drasha for another time. It's not a topic right now. But in a broader sense, working on our marriage, according to this reading of the Gemara, working on our marriages, making them front and center, prioritizing how we can improve and try to the best of our ability to move closer towards the ideal relationship of connection and trust and safety and intimacy and togetherness, that movement, that effort is what is going to transition the end of this long night into the beginning of daybreak, into the beginning of the arrival of Mashiach and the light that we're all awaiting for. So what we're doing tonight is not just stam, psychological, social work webinar on marriage. What we're doing tonight is something that is the Holy of Holies. It's the Kodesh HaKadoshim. A person's innermost world is their Holy of Holies, and that, as many, many different sources tell us, is really in our lives, is our marriages. So what we're doing tonight is of the holiest things in the world. It's a sacred calling. It's a sacred task. This is the Kodesh HaKadoshim. So to get to our specific topic within that world of the Kodesh HaKadoshim of marriage, the topic that we're discussing tonight is, can I fix my spouse? This is a topic that got me many, many comments along the way in the past few weeks from people that I've bumped into in Chicago. I guess it caught people's attention. And it's interesting. People have a lot to say on this. And what I've found is that nearly everybody has commented to me, of course not. Of course you can't fix your spouse. You can only work on yourself. And anyone who thinks they could fix their spouse, that's ridiculous. And I find it very interesting that that's the trend. That's the, I don't mean this so negatively, but that's the fad in a sense nowadays, right now, of the notion of what marriage is. No, of course you can't fix your spouse. You can only fix yourself. So I want to discuss this a little bit because it's interesting. To me, actually, the reason why I chose this topic was because I thought it would get all those comments. And I want to try and share with you a perspective that I think is very important. So as a caveat or a disclaimer to this talk, I need to say the following, which is that in a certain sense, we really cannot actually speak about this topic in any public forum. So this is a talk that there are many, many people listening to. I don't remember the exact number, but there's a lot of people on here. We can't talk about this in a way that's going to address hundreds of people at the same time. Because the reality is that every single situation is very different, and every situation requires its own nuances. And there are oftentimes two different couples that actually need the exact opposite advice of each other. The halacha is, it's very interesting when it comes to Parah Aduma, it's metameh the tahorim and metaher the tameim, meaning that when the Kohen purifies the person who's impure, the Kohen becomes impure. So the person who's impure becomes pure, and the person who's pure becomes impure from the very same action. Which means to say, says Rav Moshe Sternbach, means to say that what we have to understand is that in our lives, there are things that for us are the right thing, and that exact same thing for somebody else will be the dead wrong thing. And something that is the right thing for someone else will be totally wrong for us. And vice versa. So we have to understand that when we talk about these types of ideas about how to improve a marriage and what's supposed to go on in a marriage, it's very difficult. Maybe in a sense, it's actually dangerous to talk about it in such broad terms, in a way as if what we're going to say is relevant and practical and appropriate for each person who's listening. And so it's very important that anybody who's listening understand that what I want to do in this talk is I want to describe to you not a solution for how to fix something that you feel might be problematic in your relationship. In order to talk about how to fix something that is, in a sense, broken, that requires completely individual attention, in my view. That cannot be spoken about in a forum of a webinar. Because to fix something that is problematic in a real way, there is no generic answer. It is completely individualized, completely case by case. What I want to do instead is describe to you what a marriage in its ideal form should be like. Of course, no one's marriage is going to be the ideal perfection form of it, but I think it's a very healthy thing for us, for all of us, societally, culturally, even if it's not even for our own marriage. It's just as parents, it's going to, as grandparents, as people who are going to, God willing, if you're blessed with children, you're going to see your children get married, and maybe you're going to talk to them along the way and going to give them advice or whatever it is. And for your own marriage, to have a sense of what is a marriage supposed to look like. You know, it's very interesting. A lot of people get married without ever having been exposed to a marriage that they would say is what I want to emulate. I have somebody that I've worked with in different contexts. I don't know if she'd want me to name her, but she's a very, very well-known, very popular speaker, very well-known, and speaks a lot about marriage and about marital intimacy and all of these types of topics. And she told me that she did a poll once where she asked, she's a college teacher, a dating coach, etc. And she did a poll, and I think maybe she actually does this with her kallahs when she's doing kallah classes. She asks them along the way, name me the five primary marriages that you've been exposed to in your life, and then tell me which of them, if any, you want to emulate in your marriage. And what she found is that all too often, people have not been exposed to any marriage that they actually want to emulate. And so what I mean to say is, I don't mean to say that in a pessimistic or depressing way. Again, I don't see it like that. I want to go back to the introduction I gave, that we are in the generation that this is the holy work, and that's why it's more challenging. This is our ground of work, and therefore it meets us with many challenges. It's not a negative thing. In a sense, it's actually, like I said, it's a holy, sacred calling upon us. But I bring that up because my point is to say that most of us, many people, do not necessarily have an image of what they think marriage is supposed to look like. And so what I want to do now is paint for you a description of what I think it's supposed to look like with regards to this topic of can I fix my spouse? So here we go. What does an ideal marriage look like? An ideal marriage is entered by two people who bring with them, each of them bring many strengths and many gifts into the relationship. Gifts of their personality, gifts of who they are, different things that they have a natural proclivity towards, a natural talent, things that they're good at, things that they do well. And then they also bring with them as they enter the relationship, they come with weaknesses and they come with shortcomings. They have areas that need improvement. Many of them. It might be different aspects of their character traits, different aspects of their habits or their lifestyles. They have areas of weakness. And so each of the two people is coming into the relationship with areas of strength and areas of weakness. And in the ideal relationship, the way a marriage is meant to be, both of those people feel from the other person, they feel a deep and profound sense of being valued and appreciated for their strengths. They feel that the things that they are good at and the things they like are seen positively by their spouse. They also feel, in addition to feeling a sense of appreciation about their strengths, they feel accepted for who they are as a whole. There's a difference between feeling appreciated and feeling appreciated for a strength and being accepted as a whole. So number one, they feel a sense of being appreciated for their strengths. And number two, they feel a sense of being accepted by the other person at large, accepted as a whole, which includes their weaknesses. They're accepted not in the sense that their weaknesses are not a problem, but they're accepted in the sense that it's not a problem that you have a problem. There's a subtle point here, meaning the spouse does not need to make me feel that it's perfectly okay that I struggle with X. And therefore, the struggle with X is just accepted and it doesn't have to change. Instead, being accepted as a whole means that I feel that my spouse accepts that I need to work on X. Furthermore, I feel valued as a person in and of itself, that there's a sense of dignity, a sense of worth, a sense of being valued just as a human being. And part of all of this is that my spouse in the ideal marriage gives me feedback to see my blind spots, because we all have blind spots. And in the ideal marriage, I know that I have blind spots. I am blind to those spots, but I'm not blind to the fact that I have blind spots. And I actually want to hear where I have blind spots. We're going to get back to this in a minute. Want to hear doesn't mean I enjoy hearing it, but it means on a meta level, I want to hear that. And I understand that that's part of what a marriage is supposed to be about, is that I'm given feedback to see my blind spots and that I'm able to therefore work on wherever it is that I'm falling short for my spouse. Ideally, we should want this. I want to just spend a minute on what I mean by want this, like I said before. What I find, it's interesting, I find that there are two extremes. There's three types of people in general, two extremes in the middle. When it comes to receiving critical feedback, there are some people who can't hear critical feedback at all. So they just don't hear it. They will get defensive, they'll minimize, they'll gaslight, they'll blame, they'll distract, they'll avoid, they'll fight back, whatever it is, they will find their way to get away from any critical feedback. That's some people. Second group is the people who, and I put this in quotes, if you can, air quotes, if you can see me on the screen, people who love getting critical feedback. They love getting critical feedback. I'll explain in a minute why I put that in quotes. And then there's people in the middle who do not enjoy, they don't love getting critical feedback. They actually do not enjoy it at all. It's not an enjoyable experience. No one wants to see that they fell short or they're not good at something. It's not pleasant, but they want it in the sense that they know it's important and they know that they need it and they know that they grow from it and they tolerate it and they even invite it in a sense, almost begrudgingly, but they invite it. Obviously, the side of the spectrum that just categorically rejects any critical feedback is problematic because they can't grow, they can't be in a deep relationship, they can't hear the other person. The side that loves feedback is probably better than the other side, but there's something funny about it, if you know what I mean. There's something that might feel inauthentic, not totally real, or not totally embodied, because the human experience by nature is to not appreciate or not enjoy seeing something that's not great about ourselves. The middle group is really what we want to strive for. We are authentic in the reality of being embodied and being human, which is that it's not pleasant to hear something negative about ourselves, but we also know that we need it and we know that it's good for us, and therefore we value it and we invite it despite the fact that it is unpleasant. In a ideal marriage, that goes on. That is part of the relationship. Not only is that part of the relationship, it's actually an essential part of the relationship. Now, I don't mean that it's an essential part of the relationship or that it's a major part of the relationship. I don't mean that in the sense that quantitatively it's a major part of the relationship. I don't mean that every 5 minutes that's happening, or every hour, or even every day, or even every week, or even every month. That's not what I mean. When I say it's an essential part of the relationship or a major part of the relationship, I mean qualitatively. That I see my marriage as a grounds for my growth, and therefore I want that kind of feedback. And in the ideal relationship, that is going in both directions, meaning I want that and you want that. And if we both want that, that means that we can also give that to each other, and we don't need to be so scared of giving that kind of feedback to each other. In an ideal marriage, the answer to the question of can I fix my spouse? I know not everybody is going to agree with me, but in an ideal marriage, the answer to can I fix my spouse? I don't think I would use the word fix because I don't like that word. It's just meant as a provocative title to grab people's attention. I wouldn't use the word fix. But the answer is yes, because that's actually what marriage is about. Again, I don't mean it's what marriage is about in the quantitative sense. I don't mean that marriage is about that and therefore we do that all the time. But qualitatively, that is actually what marriage is about. That is what it means when the Torah says that when a person gets married, it's a very interesting thing. When it comes to Adam and Chava, the first marriage and the first people to live, the Torah says, Al ken yazov ish es aviv es imo, that the man leaves his parents. Let me ask you a question. Did Adam have parents? Who was he leaving when the Torah says he leaves his parents? Adam didn't have parents. And Chava didn't have parents. It wasn't like, oh, we're going to fight over whose parents and in-laws are we going to for Yontif. There were no parents. So what does it mean talking about Adam and Chava to leave one's parents? What does that mean? So there's different ways to read the psukim. This is not the only possible answer, and maybe it's not even the pshat. But one way to look at it is it doesn't mean biological parents in the sense of that you have a mother and a father and you have to leave them. It means that where you come from, what you're coming into the relationship with, what you're entering this marriage with, in order to have the hayu lebasar echad, which is what the Torah describes as the ideal accomplishment of marriage, that union, the hayu lebasar echad, in order to be able to get there, you need to have the capacity, the willingness to move away from the status quo of what you entered with. Aviv v'imo, not biologically, but figuratively, archetypally, if that's a word. That the parents, meaning what I'm coming in with, is something that, of course, I want to take all the goodness I'm coming in with. I want to bring all the strengths. I want to bring everything that I inherited and everything that I've worked for and accomplished over my life until this point. But I also want to hold it a little bit more lightly with a willingness for change. And both people need to be able to do that. And if both of us are coming with that mindset, what that actually means is that we wanted that from each other. We help each other do that. That's the growth. And when I can receive your feedback and you can receive my feedback, and it means that I change myself and I work on myself because of what you've opened my eyes to, and you work on yourself because of what I've opened your eyes to, that creates an incredible sense, an incredible level of connection, of deep connection, of something very rich, very rich. If I can feel that you actually heard me, and you took seriously what I felt from the way that you said something or the way that you acted, and it turned into something that you're working on, and years later I can see that you're a different person because of it, that is powerful. That's uniting in a way that nothing else could ever accomplish. If we remove that from the dynamic of marriage, the marriage is missing something essential. If we fall into this trend that is so pervasive now, that marriage is not meant to be that I tell you what I feel about how you're working on about yourself. No, I can only work on myself. I can only fix myself. I can't tell you what I think you need to do. No, we If we fall into that trap of this trend of what's going on, we are taking away the an essential part of what creates a level of intimacy and connection that is so powerful. The fact that we change each other is part of what makes this union something that nothing else can ever compare to. It's part of what bonds us, part of what binds us to each other, is that we improve each other. This is what the Torah means when it describes Chava as Ezer Kenegdo for Adam. Ezer Kenegdo, she's helping him by facing him. Ezer, she's a help to him. Kenegdo, by being against him. Doesn't mean against him that she's fighting him. It means that she is helpful to him by way of critique, in a sense. Now, in order to be able to do that, there are three things, I believe, that a marriage needs on a consistent basis. Really, two things which are required in order for the third thing, which is this feedback piece. The three things that I think a healthy, ideal marriage consists of on a consistent basis. In terms of communication, a marriage consists of many, many things. I'm not going into all of them. But in terms of communication, a marriage needs to consist of three things in both directions. Number one, appreciation. I already mentioned these, but I want to review them more clearly. Number one is appreciation. Both spouses need to be consistently highlighting each other's strengths, sharing the knowledge of what you do for me, that I am expressing verbally my appreciation for who you are, what you do, and how good you are at certain things. This is more important for men to be hearing, meaning it's more needed for the man to feel that his wife is appreciating what he does and his strengths. It's necessary for both, to be clear on this. It's necessary in both directions. The wife needs to hear from the husband, and the husband needs to hear from the wife about the fact that my spouse knows my strengths, appreciates my strengths, is impressed by my strengths, and not only my strengths, but what I actually do, knows what I do, appreciates what I do, is impressed by what I do. That is necessary in both directions, but I also want to again highlight it's even more necessary for the husband to be hearing that from the wife. The second thing, so the first is appreciation, the second is love. That there needs to be verbal expression of acceptance of the person as a whole, that there is expression of fondness. Of love, not of your strengths necessarily, not of what you do, that's more the appreciation piece, but love is about who you are, your being, not what you do, not your talents, but just your being in and of itself. Expressions of love and care and desire. That one, that piece is also necessary in both directions, from husband to wife and wife to husband. However, unlike the first one, this one's the inverse. This one, the love piece, is more essential for the wife to be hearing from her husband. So both appreciation and love are necessary in both directions, but appreciation is needed more by the husband and love is needed more by the wife. The third piece that is essential for a deep and real relationship and marriage to thrive and to have the richness that a marriage built over years can accomplish and can attain. The third piece is feedback, is the expressions of feeling disappointed when that's relevant, feeling hurt, feeling frustrated, feeling angry, feeling that there's something that needs to be changed, something that needs to be worked on. That is the third component in a healthy, ideal marriage is feedback. Now, it's very important to recognize that while, in my view, feedback is just as important as appreciation and love, the difference is that you can't do the feedback one if you're not doing the appreciation and the love ones. You need to have appreciation and love in order to be able to do feedback. But feedback is just as important. And in terms of quantity, I don't have like some cute like ratio to give you. But in terms of quantity, feedback should be far less often than appreciation and love. Appreciation and love should be happening on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, should be happening all the time. Feedback should be happening at specific moments, at the right moments, in the right ways. It needs to be much more measured, much more intentional, much more careful. But it needs to be there. Without it, the marriage is missing. It's like a three-legged stool, these three pieces. Appreciation, love, and feedback are a three-legged stool. You take away one of the legs, the whole thing falls over. So the truth is, if you take away feedback, I don't know that the whole thing falls over. It's just not as good of a chair. If you take away appreciation or love, the thing it falls over. If you take away feedback, I don't know that it falls over, but it's missing, deeply and profoundly missing what it really could be. Okay, so let me try and describe for you in a little bit more detail some examples of what I mean about appreciation, about love, and about feedback. So I'm going to give you an example, and then I'll show you what each of them would sound like, okay, in both directions. So here's my example. You could think of, I mean, a million examples of these things, but one example is a couple goes away to the wife's family for Yontif. Okay, so a couple with kids, let's say, goes away to the wife's family for Yontif. So, in an ideal, again, I'm describing for you the ideal marriage. In an ideal marriage, at some point on that trip, ideally earlier on, the wife will express to her husband something along the lines of the following, of appreciation. Thank you for working so hard, being so talented and smart, that you make a parnassa that allows us to fly our family to be with my family. Thank you for being so positive about visiting my family. Thank you for taking off work so that you can do the Chol Moed trips with us. Right? That's an expression of what I mean when I talk about appreciation. Those are all different examples of appreciating what he does, what his talents are, and what he's chosen to do for her and for the family. The husband's expression of appreciation, again, an example in this context of the couple going to the wife's family for Yontif, the husband might express something that says, thank you for packing all the kids. Thank you for watching all the kids while I was in shul for so long, because I know Yontif davening can be really long. And thank you for giving me a minute to answer that work email while we were at the amusement park. Okay? So that's example of what I mean by appreciation. Simple, straightforward. Obviously, I'm reading it to you off of, having thought of an example, so it sounds a little bit more robotic. Obviously, we want it to be a little bit more human and more natural, but I'm just trying to give you examples. In that context, the same context of going away for Yontif, what does love sound like? Love sounds like this. The wife is saying to the husband, I'm so happy you're off of work for a few days because I love getting to spend more time with you. Notice the difference in appreciation and love. Appreciation was about what he does, what he's good at. The expression of love is not about that. The expression of love is about you. Not what you do, but you. So the expression of appreciation is thank you for working so hard and being so talented that you earn a parnassa that allows us to do this. The expression of love is thank you for taking off of work so that I could be with you because I love getting to spend more time with you. You see, the difference is very important. A marriage needs both of these factors. Or, let's say, the husband to the wife. I mean, this could be in either direction, but an expression of love. I'm so happy the kids are finally asleep so that we can actually spend a few minutes together. I've been looking forward to that all day. Again, that's not about what you do, it's about you. It's about my desire for you, for time with you, for being able to be with you. Right? I love being able to talk to you, etc. Okay? So that's what I mean by love. Now, let's go to feedback. So that's appreciation and love. In the same context, the same example of going to the wife's family for Yontif. So here's an example of feedback. The wife says to the husband, when you get home from a long davening on Yontif and I'm depleted from the kids, you seem to take my exhaustion personally, and that just makes it even harder for me. Can you please try and understand that when I'm just wiped out and it's not meant as anything against you? Okay, that's one example. Or another example of feedback in this context. When you're with my family, this is wife to husband, when you're with my family, it feels like the conversations often end up turning into heated arguments. which is really not enjoyable for me. I'm not saying it's all your fault. I know my father and brothers can stir things up, but I really wish you'd find a different way to respond to them. That's feedback. Now, husband to wife feedback in the same context. Husband says, "It's hard for me that sometimes when we're with your family, it feels like I drop way lower down on your radar and priority list compared to your mother, sisters, friends back home. I really wish you would make me feel more prioritized on these trips." Or another example in the same context. "I understand that it's hard when there's a long Yontif davening, but I can't really have all the kids thrown at me in shul in the middle of davening. It makes a scene, it makes me uncomfortable. And then I know you think I can just get them to groups, but it doesn't go that easily, and I miss half of davening." Okay, so those are examples of feedback. So without one and two, without appreciation and without love, the feedback can't happen. However, without the feedback, the marriage can never reach the levels of depth and meaning and bonding that a marriage is supposed to reach through Ezer Kenegdo and through Al Kein Yazov Ishes Aviv Es Imo, V'hayu L'b and eventually V'davka B'Ishto, and V'hayu L'basar Echad. This is what a marriage is supposed to be. It's supposed to be a place that we grow and a place that we become better people, and that we're doing that for ourselves and we're doing that for our spouse. And so we are helping each other do that. That is what we're here for. I actually think it's very important to think about this as maybe, in a sense, a new way of thinking about the concept of Basharit. You know, we have this this notion that there's this person that is predestined, predetermined. It's my soulmate. It's my Basharit. We know this is a real thing. You know, there's different opinions about what exactly that means, and it's a real sugya. It's a sugya to learn in a real way, and it's not simple what exactly it means. But there's something real about this concept. And the way that people often understand this concept is to say that my Basharit means that there's a perfect person for me to be married to. And what I think that means to most people, influenced by the Western culture around us, is what does it mean? The automatic assumption of these words, there's the perfect person for me to be married to, without even realizing what we're assuming, we assume what that means is there's the perfect person for me to be happy. This is the perfect person for me to just to be in love, to be happy. But I actually think that Basharit means something else. It means there's the perfect person for me to have to work on myself. Because you know what actually happens in most marriages, and I believe this is by design, by divine design, is that the person you marry is actually not the perfect person for you to just feel good. They are usually the perfect person for surfacing and holding up a mirror to all the things you really need to work on. And that means in both directions, we are automatically doing that for each other. What we need to do is figure out how to do that well. So what I want to share with you now is a concept, a way of thinking about how we can do this well. How can we think of this notion of being the Basharit for the other person and seeing the other person as our Basharit? What does it mean to see the positives and to see the weaknesses, to see the strengths and the weaknesses in the other person? Give me one second. I apologize because I see that my computer is for some reason not charging, and I would not want it to die in the middle of this. That would not be good. I'm sorry. Give me one second. Okay, I think we're good. So I want to share with you a concept that I think is very important. It comes from the Torah. The Torah describes to us in Parshas Ki Tsetse, we're not up to that right now, obviously, but there is in that Parsha a beautiful concept that I want to read to you. Hold on one second. So the Torah says like this. It's towards the very beginning of the parsha. It says, "Ki sihiena leish shtei nashim, ha'achas ahuva v'ha'achas sinua." Okay, so the Torah tells us about a man who has two wives. Now, we don't have this in practice anymore. It's not allowed, but we know that the Torah is eternal. The Torah is nitzchi. The Torah is eternal. So that means that the Torah has that every single word in the Torah has relevance for all times. So the question we have to ask is, if we are no longer able to have two wives, what is the relevance? What's the nitzchius, the eternality of the parsha in the Torah that tells us about having two wives? So I want to suggest the following. The Torah is teaching us about two wives is actually incredibly relevant to us right now in 2025. Because it's not talking about having two wives. I'm going to say spouses because I'm going to put this idea into both directions. It's not specifically husband to wife. The idea of having two wives or having two spouses is not about two separate people. What it means on a nitzchias level, obviously on a pshat level, it actually means back in the day he had two wives. But on a deeper, eternal level, what I believe it means is like this. It's saying to each and every one of us, if you look at your spouse, your one spouse, because you only have one, your one spouse, if you look at him or you look at her as two separate people, what are the two people? Ha'achas ahuva, ve'ha'achas sinua. You see in this one person the features, the parts of them, the character traits, the aspects of who they are that you love. And then you see in them the aspects of who they are, their character traits, the things about them, the way they live, that you hate, that you dislike, sinua, that you dislike. If you see those different parts, their strengths and their weaknesses, their attractive and unattractive aspects of themselves, if you see that in them as two separate people, which is the way that most of us think about human beings, this person has a strength and this person has a weakness, two separate things. If I see them as two separate things, then the Torah is saying, let me tell you what's going to happen. The Torah is telling you. The Torah is telling you, here's what's going to happen if you see your wife in that way. Here's what's going to happen if you see your spouse, your husband in that way. That there's a part of them I like and a part of them I don't like, and it's two separate things. Here's what'll happen. V'yaldu lo vanim ha'ahuva v'hasnua. They'll each have children. V'haya ha'ben ha'bechor lasnia. And the older child is going to be from who? From the disliked version of your wife. And then it goes on to say that when it comes time for inheritance, who is going to take the double portion, the child of the one that you dislike? In other words, it's not necessarily talking about biological children, because again, we're not talking about two actual separate people. It's saying your focus, your attention, your energy is going to get consumed. It's going to become ruminating. It's going to become more hyper-focused on which of the two people that you're seeing in this one person, you're going to become hyper-focused on the parts you dislike. Meaning that what the Torah is telling us is if you want to see your spouse positively, you have to understand that people do not have strengths and weaknesses like we usually think or like people usually say. People do not have blessings and curses, gifts and shortcomings, strengths and weaknesses. That's not actually how it works. It's not two separate spouses in this spouse. Rather, it's one person. What does it mean it's one person? It's not strengths and weaknesses. It's qualities, character traits. And every single quality, every single character trait has something positive to it. And the very same positive character trait has a cost. It has something that is a shortcoming. But the shortcoming, the cost, is because of the gift. Every single quality, every aspect of a person is a gift, and every gift has a cost. because we live in a finite world. Humans are finite. Human character traits are finite. And because we live in a finite world, that means that everything has a cost. Nothing is free. Nothing is free. Everything has a cost. If I want, you know, the classic line, you can't have your cake and eat it too. It's actually, if you stop and think about what the line means, the saying means, it's actually very profound. It's saying, if you want to have a beautiful cake in front of you, you can't have the deliciousness of tasting, of eating it, because then you don't have it sitting in front of you all pretty. If you want to eat this delicious cake and you want to have that experience, it won't be sitting in front of you all nice. If you have passion, if you're a passionate person, which is a tremendous gift, what's the cost of passion? Passion comes with a cost because everything has a cost. Nothing is free. Only in Hashem himself is there anything that's actually perfect without cost. But we are not God. So even our gifts come with costs. So take, for example, passion. A person is passionate. It's a tremendous gift. Leads to all sorts of amazing things. The cost of passion is anger. The cost of passion is anger. People who are passionate are more prone to anger. It's not that they have a strength of passion and a weakness of anger. They have a gift of passion that has the cost of anger. Take another example. You have a person who's very practical, down to earth, practical, action-oriented person. That is a gift. These people can get things done. They're a doer. Now, the cost of that gift of being a very practical doer person, the cost of that is that they can be insensitive, because that's not where they go. They just go to the action. How do we solve this? What do we do about it? Let's take care of it. And the cost of that is insensitivity. But it's not a gift. It's not a strength and a weakness. It's a gift, and the gift has a cost. You have a person who is very deep thinker, contemplative, thinks out of the box, is thinking independently as an for themselves, and thinks deeply and profoundly. The cost of that is that they can be an overthinking person. They can ruminate on things. You can have a person who's very organized, which is a beautiful gift, and the cost of being very organized, that they can be very controlling. When we look at our spouse as two separate things, that's what the Torah is telling us, two wives in this person, what's going to end up happening is that the negative parts are going to overtake me. And now I'm going to be seeing them half glass, you know, half empty. I apologize. The glass half empty. That's what the Torah is telling us. And what it's implying is that what we need to do is see it as one person. It's one character trait. And every gift comes with a cost. I once had a couple that I was working with that I shared this idea with, and the husband was a very, very deep thinker. Kind of sometimes the cost of his depth was not so much that he was an overthinking person in a ruminating or obsessing way, but his cost was that he was a little bit spacey. So he would never be able to follow instructions on the GPS or remember where he put his keys. He was very spacey. That was the cost of his gift. And we were working on this and talking about it in couples therapy. And one session they came in, they were all excited to tell me that they were driving somewhere and he had missed the turn. He had missed the exit on the highway. And normally this would have been a moment of deep frustration for his wife, and then he would be frustrated and it would spiral into all sorts of things. And they came in excited to tell me that when he missed the exit on the highway, because he was just spacing out, thinking about, I don't know, some like really deep idea, his wife, instead of getting angry, said out loud to him, she said, "Well, that's just the cost of being you. And I'm happy I get to have you." And that's the cost. If you want to have a really good steak, it costs money. If you want to go on a really nice vacation, it costs money. Everything has a cost. Every gift of every human trait comes with a cost. And instead of seeing our spouse's weaknesses as separate from their strengths, they are the costs of their strength. And when we see our spouse in this way, and we deeply internalize this and see it this way in an authentic, genuine way, it changes the dynamic of how we give them the feedback that's so critical for us to give them. Because it comes from a place that is not separate from the appreciation and the love that I spoke about as the first two components. It actually emerges and flows from within the same context as the appreciation and the love. Even though, yes, when I express the feedback, I might be expressing it from a more frustrated place. So now, what does it mean that I'm trying to help you change? I'm trying to help you grow. If I'm supposed to understand that your shortcomings are not actually problems, they're just the costs of your gift. It would almost sound like what I'm saying now, like someone would say, what are you talking about, Danishevsky? You're contradicting everything you said until now. Until now, you were telling us that in a marriage, there has to be that we're working on ourselves and we're giving each other feedback of where we're falling short. But now you're telling us that all the shortcomings are not really separate things that need to be changed. They're the costs of the gifts. So let me try and explain to you the way that I see it. The way that I see it is that it is inevitable and inescapable as human beings that every gift we have has a cost. However, don't overpay for your gift. That's the key. Just like that piece of steak might be really delicious and therefore it costs more than another piece of steak, but don't overpay for it. And that vacation is worthwhile, or that car is worthwhile, or this whatever it is that you're going to pay for, but you don't want to overpay for it. The work that we are doing on ourselves and the work that we are enabling our spouse to do by giving them appreciation, love, and feedback is we are helping them balance out and budget, in a sense, their spending. Because so often what happens for most of us, and this is not the time to explain the depths as to why this happens, but what happens for most of us is that our biggest challenges in our personalities are because we are overpaying for our gifts. So the person with major anger issues is really a passionate person who will never not have some level of anger because that's the cost of your gift of passion. But they might be dramatically overpaying and they need to deal with that. The practical doer person is never going to be as sensitive as the empath. Because they are a practical person, that's their gift, and that's the cost of their gift. But that doesn't mean they have to overpay for their practicality by being completely insensitive. The deep person doesn't have to overpay for their depth by being completely out of control in their obsessive thinking. They can learn to have some control. They can learn to scale back how much they're spending on their gift. And that's what we're all trying to do for ourselves, and that's what we're all trying to help our spouse do, is to spend appropriately for your gift. This is why in Torah, what is a character trait? It's a midah. A midah is a measurement. What does it mean to have good midos? Work on your midos. The Vilna Gaon says the whole purpose of your life is to work on your midos. What does it mean to have good midos like we talk about, or not good midos? It doesn't mean to have good character traits. Every character trait is good. The question is, what's its measurement? Good midos means good measurements. It means you have the right amount of it, the right amount of passion, so you're not overspending on your passion with anger, the right amount of practicality, so you're not overspending on your practicality by being insensitive, the right amount of depth, so you're not overspending on your depth by being too overthinking, etc. So every gift comes with a cost. But we don't have to, and we don't want to overspend. And that's what we're trying to do in our marriages. We are trying to improve ourselves and to improve each other, to hone our gifts, to refine our gifts, to get them to the proper measurements so that we're not overspending on them. And when we see each other in that light, and we can express appreciation, and we can express love, and we can express feedback. When we do this in the right way, with Hashem's help, the result, when it has all three of those components, and we don't take away the feedback component, the result is something truly, truly incredible. Truly incredible. Because when that refinement of midos, the refining of our gifts, and the refining of how much we spend happens because of feedback you've given me, that experience that you have of having helped me grow and having felt that your feelings matter to me. And my experience of being able to look back and say, you know why I got better at this? You know why I feel better in my life about this? Because my wife or my husband actually helped me get there. And vice versa. That is an incredible, incredible experience. Something that nothing else could ever, ever touch. And that's the Kodesh Kodashim. And that, as I started with, is the Mishmar Achron, the very last watch of this very long Golus. And when we can, to the best of our ability, strive a little bit more and a little bit more to do this, that's Emir Tzah Hashem, what brings the Geula. So, like I said in the beginning, what I just tried to paint for you is the picture of the ideal, romanticized, I don't mean romantic, but I mean idealized version of a marriage. Of course, everyone in their particular situation has many different nuances and aspects of their personality, their spouse's personality, and that's where the work for people who are struggling with something that's more challenging needs to be completely individualized. So nothing I said here was meant to be specifically, practically applicable to any particular situation, but instead to try and share concepts, painting what the, in my view, what the Torah's view of the ideal marriage is supposed to be. And Hashem should help each one of us in our own way, on our own path, in the right way to be able to accomplish this. And through that, we accomplish the Mishmar Achron of Isha Misaperes and Baila, of two spouses talking to each other closely in a way that brings the beginning of day, the beginning of Mashiach. Thank you very much for being here and being part of this, and I wish everyone a good night.
Thank you, Rabbi Danishevsky. Really appreciate this wonderful evening. I'm sure this covered a lot of ground that everyone was really eager to hear. Thank you for covering the questions that came in prior, interspersed in your class as well. Really appreciate it. If anybody has any other questions they'd like to send to Rabbi Danishevsky, could they send some to our way, send over to your email perhaps? If any lasting questions, I don't think we can do it now in the Q&A. It's time's up now, but if you have any other questions, you can send it over to my email, agoodman@thechicagocenter.org, and I'll forward it over to Rabbi Danishevsky. Or alternatively, I'll send Rabbi Danishevsky's email, his contact information, and also reach out for his book. Can read his podcast as well. Well, each source has much to offer, rich knowledge I'm sure everyone can gain. Looking forward to hearing your responses and feedback, everybody, and have a wonderful night. Thank you, Rabbi Danishevsky.
Thank
And thanks
you.
for making this evening happen.
Thank you so much. Have a good night.
Thank you very much. Be well.